Welcome to the Money Advantage Podcast, empowering business owners with the permission to think differently about money so that you can consciously choose to live a meaningful and fulfilled life now. Our passion is making money simple, fun, and doable, helping you feel great about your money and getting your money working for you so you can thrive.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Money Advantage community, and anyone who is chiming in to the live today. This is Rachel Marshall and Bruce Wehner, and today we're talking again about our favorite topic, Bruce. At least it's our favorite topic together, the infinite banking and becoming your own banker. So we're continuing on our series. And if you've been with us for a while, we've been diving through this book. We're almost to the end. And there's so much to discuss. Last time we said we were going to cover with you the 7 top money myths that cause people to lose money and be out of financial control. And, you know, we did not get through all 7. So we're going to continue that conversation today with the last 4 of the big money myths that are laid out in Nelson Nash's book, Becoming Your Own Banker, on the section called Points to Consider on page 85, written by David Stearns, that was kind of a compilation of everything in the book with all of Nelson's ideas wrapped together. And Bruce, I'm really excited to continue on this conversation with you because it's just that important that we really get these things right about our thinking in terms of money so that we can get in financial control. And so I'm really excited for this 27th episode in this series that we've been doing together.
Yeah, we've gotten, when we've had meetings with new people, they've actually commented on us going through the book on the podcast. And so people are finding it valuable. Another one of the Nelson Nash practitioners, students that I'm mentoring, he and I had a long talk last night. And he was concerned that, you know, he wasn't getting through to people. And I said, well, first, you know, let's start by just having them read the book. And he goes, they won't even read the book. Mm. And I said, well, then you just have to move on. And Nelson used to talk about this all the time, is that it's rethinking your thinking is what you need to do to understand this. But unlearning what you've previously learned is very difficult for people, very difficult. And I've mentioned this on the podcast before, and I mentioned it to the student last night, is that it's very difficult to unlearn something, because then you have to admit to yourself that you were thinking wrong the entire time. And it takes it's a hard lesson to learn that you did that. Now, I always say to people, including clients, you made the best decision with the information you had at the time you were making the decision. Now you have new information, so maybe you'll make a new decision. Mm. And that's the whole purpose of going through this book, is to show people that there's new information to them. Although this information is actually very old. It's very sound money that's been going on for 200 plus years. And Nelson, we ended last podcast with Nelson talking about putting as much premium as possible into your bank instead of someone else's bank. And he also said that, you know, you'd want to put as much premium as possible in that if it's your bank. You can't do that right away. Matter of fact, Nelson said, we ended this with the average person, it takes about 20 years to do this. And, but this should be the goal. We talk about this all the time in other aspects of our life. If you had a hardware store, wouldn't you go to your hardware store? If you had a restaurant, wouldn't you go to your restaurant and you would pay for the things you bought at your hardware store? You'd pay for the things at your restaurant. Why? Because that goes back into the restaurant and hardware store and builds up the equity, and that builds up more capital for you. People are missing the boat about storing capital. This technique is about storing capital and getting uninterrupted, tax-free growth and still being able to use your money along the way. So keep that in mind as we finish up this series, because it's going to come into play on the very first topic.
And Bruce, as usual, when you share, then I have something that just brings up so much for me. So I'm going to go back to the idea that you said, you know, we can be challenged to rethink our thinking because it's difficult to admit that we didn't do things perfectly in the past. And I think we have to hold two components in our hands that are almost opposing ideas with that, because we have to make decisions today and we have to be able to move forward and be confident enough to make a decision and know that we're doing the best with what we can do right now, and yet be willing to open our mind and be willing to admit that there might be a better way to see things. And that's really difficult. And I know for a fact, because I was just in a conversation yesterday with a bunch of women who are continuing to grow and build their families and support businesses and integrating those things together in their life, where they're, most of them are working with spouses as well in business. And what's really fascinating is that you need to be in a community of people who are able to see something that you don't see so that they can help you have that mindset shift. And we all have to make the best decisions with the information we have right now and the circumstances that we have in our hand, and yet be open to considering there might be a different way to see the exact challenge that we're facing, because our current mindset is limiting our ability to move forward, where we need a different perspective in order to grow to another level. And that's the same thing Dan Sullivan talks about all the time as well, that you need to not solve the problems that you have in your future with the past mindset. You need to be able to reach that ceiling of complexity, think 10 times bigger, and then be able to apply that 10 times bigger thinking to your current problems. And so that happens in your financial life. And I really loved, there was another element that you shared, Bruce, this whole idea of taking 20 years to build to getting all of your capital going through an infinite banking policy. The challenge with people like me, which you're probably, you can probably relate at least in some capacity to this part of me, I like things to be done. I don't like to be in process, and I really don't like to have 100 half finished projects. I mean, that's just really overwhelming when you're like, well, I mean, even just on a simple scale, maybe you're working on one project with a child and the dishes are halfway done and there's just all these things commanding your attention. You have to stop in the middle of one thing and move on to another thing, and you have a lot going on. Any mom would know that. I'm sure that everyone else can relate to that as well. And yet at the same time, anything that's long-term, so if you have a goal that literally will take your entire lifetime to fulfill, it's always in process, which means it's never done, which means you have to be content and satisfied with where you are right now, and also continuing to reach for that next component or that next area or that next level of growth in your life. And we're always in process. And so it's about continuing to have those continuous improvements or kaizening. So amazing stuff. So let's go ahead and then jump in to number four. This is going to be our fourth money myth. Last time we covered, first, you need more household income, or you need two incomes to support a family. We talked about that and why that's not true. We then talked about future taxes aren't a big deal. That's a myth that most people think. I can just defer taxes and think about them later, or not think about them at all. And if I don't have to pay them today, that means I'm not going to have to pay them. But that's a myth. And future taxes are a huge deal that can limit your future income potential. Then we talked about the myth that you should use a bank for all of your money holding, all of the place where you store capital. And instead, Nelson and David Stearns, through Nelson Nash at the end of the book, were really talking about how you can use an infinite banking system instead. And our fourth myth is that tax-qualified retirement plans are the best way to save taxes and save for retirement. And the reason I love the way that this is worded, this is actually has so many components of what people think about for planning for the future. And Bruce, I'm sure we could talk for the next 16 days just on this one idea. But the challenge is that, first of all, many people think they're saving for retirement by doing what typical financial planning would tell them to do. It's not saving, it's investing. So we need to unpack that a little bit. Then the fact that they're saving taxes is not truly saving taxes if you just don't pay a tax today. And then having a retirement plan, or even thinking about retirement, is not necessarily a healthy view of financial life, because you're doing something that is just for a particular endpoint. You're not thinking expansively. So there's so much wrapped into this. And Bruce, I'd love to hear your thoughts as we unpack this idea.
Well, you know, this is a very, I don't want to say necessarily controversial topic, but it's a very a widely talked about topic on both sides. And I think what we have to understand is that everything, I shouldn't say everything, that's an absolute, most things we do in life produce a bell curve, so that there's some people on one end that are really, really advantageous, and some people on the other end are have some disadvantages, but most of the population ends up in the middle. So there is a supposed, when I say supposed, the reason I say that is there's a supposed retirement crisis in the United States where people do not have enough money saved for retirement. What Nelson would say, well, you shouldn't be retiring. So then you could say there's not a crisis. Just keep working like you should, so that you're contributing to society. And there's other people that are doing marketing, sensationalized marketing that says everybody should be fully funding retirement accounts, because that is the only way that you're going to actually have a fulfilled retirement. And there are people that do this. And they do that, and they're very successful. I've seen people with a couple of $1 million in retirement accounts. So nobody's going to tell me that those people are not successful if that is their goal, even if they have to pay taxes along the way. In their minds, that was successful. There are other people that have zero save for retirement, but they may have a business and other cash flowing assets that are not tax deferred. You're not going to tell me that they're not successful in what they do. It's the middle part that really has to think about, do I want or need to contribute to tax deferred accounts? And there are also other non-tax deferred accounts called Roth IRAs. And I'd like to read this point that Nelson used to make all the time. And David Stearns makes the point in his Points to Consider, because Nelson loved this quote. When a government creates a problem, in his mind, the onerous taxation, and then turns around and grants you the exception to the problem they created, aren't you a little bit suspicious that you're being manipulated? So let's walk through this. So Nelson would say, oh, the government's saying, hey, we're going to help you with this tax situation. We're going to let you tax defer your money, and that's going to help you. Then he says, well, that's one form of manipulation. So if taxes are bad, then why are you letting us take a deduction now so that we don't have them in the future? Then he said the other way that they manipulated us was in 1999. They said, well, tax deferred is really good at first. And now they say, well, no, let's let you go ahead and pay the taxes now and not pay any taxes in the future. And he's like, which is it? Should we pay the taxes now or not pay the taxes now? He said, they don't even know. So they're manipulating you. Now, tax qualified plans also do several other things. When they are in an investment account, what ends up happening, and this is one of my aha moments that I had to have when I was rethinking my thinking. I don't remember who taught me this, but it makes perfect sense. When you are tax deferring money, the part of the money that is going to the government, you have no idea how much that is, because you do not know what the tax rates are going to be at the time you take it out. But more importantly, you're paying an asset under management fee, an investment fee, a mutual fund fee. You're paying all these fees for the part that you're not even going to benefit from, because that part, tax part's going to the government. So you're paying additional fees. So when people say, oh, you shouldn't be paying commissions, you should just be paying a fee, because fees are the best way to go, do they really understand that part of that fee is actually on the taxable part that's going to the government? So you're actually paying fees that are not even benefiting you. That really hit me hard when I first thought about that. So not only are you paying fees on the portion that you're going to have, but you're also paying fees on the tax deferred portion that goes to the government. So you're paying the government's fees. So not only are you paying the taxes, you're paying the government fees. So that is a really important part. The next part is, and I've seen people introduce this to crowds at events, on YouTube, on social media, they say, it doesn't make any difference. You tax defer at a certain rate, or you pay the taxes and do a Roth and grow tax-free and then access tax-free. As long as the tax rates are the same, you end up with the same spendable amount at the end. And that's very true. That's very true. However, the presumption here is that the tax rates are going to be the same.
Which is not in our control.
That is not in our control. And frankly, I also don't understand this argument, because the earlier you start, you actually are going to be in lower tax brackets. That's the whole point of tax deferring, right? You're lowering your taxable income and you're not making as much money. Then at the end, your career, you're making more money, and then you're taking it out. You're in a higher tax bracket and you're taking it out approximately at the same tax bracket. Like I said before, I've done this analysis. This is one of the main analysis I do with people that want to do retirement. Is what tax bracket are you in now? What do you need as far as retirement income? And what tax bracket will you be in? And because the marginal tax brackets are so great, there's a lot of room in between there. Seldom do you go down into the lower tax bracket. So all that analysis has to be done. And so Nelson was also very disappointed in the fact that people thought that the stock market was just naturally going to give you between 7% and 10% mm-hmm. along the way. And he said, that's not a sure thing. Wouldn't you like guarantees in this situation? And some people don't need guarantees. And so maybe you might want to do it. So when Nelson's talking about this in the book, that you're being manipulated, he's talking about you're being manipulated on several layers when it comes to taxation. And the final Absolutely. Thing that I'll have, and then I will get your thoughts on this. He said, now there's all these exceptions that the government has to taxation. If the government really wanted you to give you a break, like they do on these deductions, why wouldn't they just cut out the taxes altogether? Why do they need to just give you a break on it? So the reason we know they won't do that, because they really don't want to do that, because Congress cannot control their spending. Whether you're on the right or the left, they all spend the same. It's a fallacy to think that one side is more responsible than the other. You can just go through and look at the history of the presidencies, and you can see that's just not true.
Absolutely. Which, what you're saying is government spending continues to increase in every administration, and it has for a very long time. Just, it depends on which projects they dedicate more funding to, but they're all continuing to spend, and the rate that our deficit is expanding is astronomically fast and high. What's really interesting as well, we've talked about this before on the show, is that the idea that putting money into tax-deferred qualified plans or qualified retirement accounts is saving is a misnomer altogether. And the reason is that savings means you're putting money into a safe location. That's why it's called savings. You are getting a return on that money, even if it might be small, but you have dollars that are not going to lose value. And I want to be clear in what I'm saying here, because sometimes people say, well, yes, your dollars that you put in the bank can lose value because inflation goes up and your money's not rising at the same rate as inflation. And so I hear this in the back of my mind every time we start talking about savings, because yes, the value of $100 tomorrow is going to be less than it is today based on inflation. However, if you put $100 in the bank, you're not going to walk in next week and them tell you your account balance is only $1. Unless someone took that money out, yourself or someone stole your money. So that is the definition of savings. You're putting your money into a location that those dollars, those financial tokens that you put in that location are preserved. They're growing at some kind of a rate of return and you have access to them. So, but the main definition of savings is that it's safe. When you put money into an investment, you have potential ups and potential downs. You have the rise in valuation and the fall in valuation. So you might invest $100, you might have a 50% loss, and that $100 goes down to $50 in your account. Then you might have a 50% gain. Pay close attention to what I'm saying here. You might have a 50% gain on that account. Your $50 then adds $25 more back. That's the definition of a 25% gain. So now you're at $75. You had a 50% loss, a 50% gain. Well, the average rate of return in this case is zero. However, you ended up at the end of that period with $25 less money than you started with. You can say to me, why is that even possible? Because we're marketed this idea that you get an average rate of return. And Bruce, when you said 7 to 10%, we think in our mind, well, it rises and it falls, but it all really evens out. And in our mind, it's really easy to think that that means, well, I can generally just expect I'm going to have 7 to 10% rate of return positive every year going forward. And that is how I interpret those numbers on my account balance. But if you have a loss first, it takes a much higher positive gain to recover from that. And so your average would need to be much higher than zero in order to just maintain an even account balance. And I think the challenge with this is that many of us shortcut those steps and we just hear, well, it's generally going to rise about 7 to 10%. And so we can just apply that to the money we're putting into retirement savings, which is not savings at all. It's truly investing. And then we misunderstand that it's not guaranteed. And we misunderstand the implications of having losses in those accounts, which can completely change our financial landscape in the future. And so when we talk about putting money aside at all, investing is a fabulous idea, but not for the purpose of having safe money, not for the purpose of having money that you can depend on in the future. And so when it was interesting when you mentioned the retirement crisis as well, I've heard those numbers and the statistics on that, and you can interpret that in multiple different ways. To be honest, I was just looking at the account, so we have a TSP, access to a TSP, and when I look at our account balance, if you looked at the account balance in that, you would say that there's a retirement crisis in our life because it's very small balance. All employer contribution, zero employee contribution. The reason I share that is that it's not the preferred method that we've chosen to put dollars aside for the future. And it's not something we're depending on or banking on. It's side frivolous money that we don't expect to stay there for us. And we know that in the eventual future, it's going to have to be taxed. It's not even an account name that's our account. It says for the benefit of us. And so when you look at all of those factors, it's not money in our control. It's not something we're putting our dollars into. And we are not thinking that that is going to be our plan for the future. I want to come back to the idea that you mentioned with retirement, because if the goal is just to step out of work completely, Nelson was against that. Another great friend of ours, Rabbi Daniel Lapin, talks about the value of not retiring and how you keep yourself mentally sharp. We look at Dan Sullivan. I'm not sure his age, 90, 80?
No, I believe he's right at 80.
I know he had a big birthday party recently.
Yeah, I think it's 80.
So looking at that, he's still working and doing a fabulous amount of work for a lot of people and helping them 10x their businesses with Strategic Coach. And so you look at all of the people who are doing powerful work later in life, retirement's not a good idea for you to be able to stay sharp, and be able to contribute at the highest level possible. However, we should plan financially for the future. We shouldn't just live for today and hope tomorrow's going to take care of itself. We really need to be able to be diligent with putting money aside. And so, is it a retirement crisis? Well, that is a great question, but we should absolutely be in financial control and storing up capital in a banking system so that we are in control and we're investing and we're continuing to increase the dollars that we have available to us because we're providing good value to other people through our direct work, through the assets that we own, through the businesses that we have, that we're serving people. We have investments that are then returning a return to us and increasing our capital. And because of all of those things, we're serving the world. And when we serve the world, we have more dollars to show for that. And that allows you to expand your influence. So you do want to be in a position of continuing to increase your income and your assets and be in a position to think long-term and think generationally with wealth.
Yeah, very good. So I think the next one is the part that I find frustrating when I talk about using specially designed life insurance contracts to store capital. And I'm going to use the practitioner student again last night. He went to a real estate group and said, hey, would you mind, that he had been in for years. He purchases real estate. He said, would you mind if I actually did a presentation on a separate place to the group, a separate place to actually store money besides the bank for the group? And the person looked at his proposal and said, no, we're going to stick with just investing in real estate and not investing in life insurance. And so right away, he told the guy, well, we're not investing in life insurance. All we're doing is saving our capital in the life insurance instead of banks. And I just think this is a really good place to do it. And a lot of real estate groups are doing it, which is true. Not all the real estate groups are doing it, in our opinion, in the correct way, but they're doing it. And so number five is wealth has to reside somewhere. Where would you prefer to reside? And this is the part.
Well, hold on one second, Bruce. So I'm going to back up really quick because that is the truth. So since we've been laying this out in terms of the myth or the thing that is untrue, I just want you to be clear when you're listening to this, that what Bruce is saying, wealth has to reside somewhere. That's not a myth. The myth would be that real estate and the stock market are the only or the best places for your capital to sit. So that's the myth. And Bruce, you're exposing the truth. Go ahead.
Correct. And so people miss this part. And it's very difficult for me because I've lived this since my entire life that, you know, that I understand that the capital has to lay somewhere. And, you know, I've been putting it in since 1963, when my parents took out a policy on me. And then in the late 80s, I started into business and started saving my capital in whole life insurance contracts. And I continue to do that today. And so I have a hard time getting it down to that level of thinking, but I think it's just about rethinking your thinking and bringing points out to people. It's about access to capital. And once again, our good friend Fritz talked about this morning. He said, a good pitch could be that to have people understand how important is capital in their life. Capital is the core driver of the economy. And this is the key. Hassle-free capital is the nirvana of economics. Boy, Fritz, thanks for putting it like that. That is an awesome way of putting it. And I'm going to pivot right here away from my student to a review that I did with one of my clients who is what I would consider pretty successful. Listen to this. He actually owns a variety of real estate to the tune of clearing $65,000 a month. So he clears $65,000 a month. He stores $100,000 a year in specially designed life insurance contracts that we set up for him in infinite banking style, with the whole idea that he is going to replace. I love his thinking. He's thinking long term because he says he's not going to stop becoming a real estate professional. He wants to think long term, and he wants to have he wants to replace a $600,000 line of credit from the bank with his own $600,000 line of credit with specially designed life insurance contracts. He got re-energized when he recently went to buy a 75-unit house, or excuse me, apartment complex. And he went to the bank to get financing. Now, this is a guy that has $65,000 of free cash flow coming in a month. I also didn't mention that he owes nothing on any of his rental properties. So they have a 100% equity in it to the tune of about $15 million. Okay. Then he goes to the bank to pick up this 75-unit property. The bank looks at the proposal and says, no thanks, we are not doing it. So banks are tightening. We're in early 2024. Banks are tightening their lending, especially on larger projects, because they don't want to be exposed. They're feeling nervous. So this is exactly what he's talking about. So he actually did some other creative financing. One thing he did was borrow against his cash value in his current policy. He paid the interest. Mm-hmm. Okay, he was a good banker, good honest banker. And he used that, and he did some other private interest swaps and so on and so forth to make it happen. So he made it happen. The point that David Stearns and Nelson makes is real estate, take a look around and see what happens when you need liquidity. Real estate is very much a frozen asset. And I know a lot of people, when I talk about this, they say, well, I have a line of credit against my real estate. I used to have a line of credit too. And in 2008, during the financial crisis, they actually cut it off. They can cut those lines of credit off at any time. And also remember, and this is what this person with the real estate was telling me. He goes, the other thing is I have to pay back on the bank's terms on the line of credit. And some people say to me, yeah, but it's only interest only. Well, but it's the interest is not set, and you still have to make the payment. At any time, you have to make the payment. The other place that wealth people think should reside is in the stock market. He says, then try reading from my recommended reading list for those interested in the stock market on page 91. Until you have done so, are you qualified to make an intelligent decision about such action?
So let's just be clear. Yeah, this is not a reading list of one book. Nelson, you mentioned he's an avid reader, and his recommendations are gigantic as well.
They are. And if you go to his reading recommendations, it can be overwhelming. I've read several. I like to read also, but Nelson is unbelievable as far as his amount of reading he has done.
That's the entire list that he has provided in his book for recommended reading just for those interested in the stock market. And I do love that he included The Prayer of Jabez by Bruce Wilkinson, which I have read that one as well. I haven't looked through the whole list. Who Moved My Cheese is on here as well.
Yeah, well, Nelson's reading was very practical because Nelson was an Austrian economist. And Austrians believe in sound money. You know, money that is not created out of thin air, money that is not leveraged, money that is saved before it is actually spent. And so it's not surprising that a lot of these concepts, books are on concepts that are very, very simple to understand. It's just that we've been thinking in such a complex way, we think, oh, simplicity can't possibly work.
Bruce, I'm going to mention as well, he also lists The Purpose-Driven Life by Rick Warren. I love that and have read these books. Then he mentions The Creature from Jekyll Island, which I know Lucas, my husband, has read. And I'm just going to give a shout out to Connor Boyack, who wrote the Tuttle Twins books. If you have children or you don't have children and you want to understand Austrian economics and sound business principles from a very basic standpoint, I highly recommend these books. We read them to our 4-year-old. Our 12-year-old reads them all the time. And they have a book called, I can't remember. They use The Creature from Jekyll Island and they rename it something else very similar And then they put it into a story that is really, really appropriate for kids, but it really helps you understand what capitalism is and what the banking system, what the Federal Reserve is, and how that was created. So I would highly recommend those books as well as Nelson's List, just because the books by Connor Boyack, the Tuttle Twins, are fabulous, helping you understand these simply and quickly.
Yes. So what Nelson was trying to compare and contrast is where people tend to put most of their wealth, store most of their wealth. He was not against real estate, but he wants people to understand that real estate does have some lack of liquidity. Nelson had a lot of real estate, but Nelson also remembers the times when he had a liquidity crisis in the early 80s, and he was at his wit's end. And actually, when the concept of infinite banking was kind of born, because he got out of his crisis by actually borrowing against his life insurance contracts. The stock market, he was never a fan of, because he believed that it was manipulated by both people that didn't understand the stock market, traders, and by the CEOs and boards of the particular stock, because all they were trying to do was keep the stock price up in a variety of manipulative ways by either refinancing, by laying people off for a short period of time, because they're looking at 90-day increments, not looking at it long-term. Mm-hmm. So that's why you get so much volatility. And then so finally he says, or you can store your money in free contracts with other free people, which are life insurance. I had this concept actually discussed the other day with a client too. You know, he said, it was a fairly new client. He said, you know, am I going to get some information so I can file my taxes? And I'm like, no, you're not going to get a 1099 on this. You don't have to worry about it. The IRS does not have to know anything. Matter of fact, nobody has to even know you have this. So don't worry about this. So that's what he means by free contracts. Says, from this base of financial operations, you can do any of the other things in life that you desire. So Nelson's saying that this should be your foundation, mm-hmm. just like we were talking about that student, that practitioner student, trying to talk to his real estate group. This should be the foundation where you store your money. Then you go buy the real estate by borrowing against the cash value. So that was number five.
I think, Bruce, there can sometimes be a misconception, especially when we talk at all about this idea of choosing to put money into life insurance or into a whole life insurance specially designed contract for cash value. There can be a misunderstanding that means it's the only thing you do. We've had people ask us, are you recommending that we put all of our money just into life insurance as the only asset that we own? And certainly not. So this is not a one solution for your entire life. This is something that, Bruce, I love how you said the foundation. That was the exact word that was on my mind. It's the base. It's the first level. It's the basement, if you will, of this house that you're building. And you're able to do so many other things as a result of having capital stored in a place that you can access. So it is liquid. It is accessible to you. Just because you have the cash value, you have access to borrow against it. You can use that capital. You can pay back at interest to the life insurance company, which increases the dividends and interest that you are paid because the insurance company is profitable. And you're in a position where you've put your capital into building this system, storing money at the life insurance company. And because of that, you are building a banking system that then continues to pay you interest and dividends in the future. So you're continuing to grow capital. And
so, that's good. That's really good. Can I, can I quickly address somebody's
yes.
comment on YouTube? They said, this is Warren. I haven't seen Warren's name before. Thanks for listening, Warren. He says, hi, Rachel and Bruce. Actually, people can put their money in safe vehicles within a qualified plan. However, most people do not save enough to accumulate sufficient assets without risk assets. So, Warren, I kind of agree with you because there are fixed income plays within qualified plans. Some people think bonds, but bonds, we found out in 2008 and recently, the value of bonds can go down. Now, the income of the bonds continues, but most people use bond money market funds, which are volatile. The other thing is people say they can put it in a money market account. Technically, I would say, or realistically, I would say they're safe. Technically, they are not safe. Money market accounts can go down. Now, do they go down? Is it likely they're going to go down? No. So there are some components of safety. I think, Warren, the other thing is that we're not, you're correct, maybe on market safety, there are ways to do this. And I highly agree with what you said, is that most people do not save enough to accumulate sufficient assets without having risk assets. Then we bring into this point that a lot of people make, is the reason that you use diversification is because you have risk in your portfolio. Well, diversification then says you're going to lose money in a portion of your portfolio. And so you are going to lose money, and it's going to offset some of the gains that you make. Warren's not wrong, but I think there's a deeper dive that you can take into this. The other risk is not stock market risk necessarily, but it's taxation risk by having money in qualified plans, which I think is actually the highest risk you could possibly take. I always tell a person, if I can save you $1 in taxes, it's another dollar that you do not have to, or you can actually spend, invest, or give away. Mm-hmm. And you can do it without risk. That's the beautiful thing about doing tax mitigation or strategic tax planning, is you're getting that rate of return without taking any risk. So thanks, Warren. You have some really good points. You can put now he says you can put a bank CD in a qualified account. Once again, yes, you can. The bank CD up to a certain amount is FDIC approved. And yes, Warren, these points are very valid. They're not backed by 100% asset. So now you get into fractional reserve banking, which may not affect you directly in your account, but fractional reserve banking has devalued our money along the way. Where when you put it into a life insurance contract, you can only lend out, the life insurance company can only lend out on a one-to-one basis of what they have in reserve. So, Warren, great points. I really appreciate the comments, and this is why Rachel and I continue to acknowledge everybody's comments, and it can work for certain people if you're disciplined enough. I think you actually hit the nail on the head, Warren, is most people do not save enough. And you need to save first before you can invest. And that's what you're talking about. So thanks a lot, Warren.
Bruce, to that point, I'm going to try to show something I just pulled up, and I hope this will be helpful, because in trying to explain a visual, it's more valuable to see it. So I'm actually going to do something that we don't usually do, and I'm going to share my screen just for a moment here. And
so while you're doing that, okay, very good.
Okay, so this is a program that we use, and it really helps me because I like to see things visually. So this is looking at the top federal tax brackets throughout history since they were instituted in 1913 with the creation of income tax and the Federal Reserve. So what is very interesting is if you look at this right here, this $100,000, say that's in your account, and that's your account balance. Watch over here where this right now, if tax is right now at zero, no tax at all in the future, then 100% of that account balance and $100,000 would be your share, and zero would be the IRS share. The problem is, and we're not going to go again into the visual representation of all the history of taxes, but let's just say taxes go to, in the future, they're at 30%. Now look over here, your share of that $100,000 balance is $70,000, and the IRS's share is $30,000. But what's to say taxes are going to be exactly that for you? What if they're going to be at 40%? Then your share is $60,000, the IRS's is $40,000. The point is that we don't know where this bar is going to fall in the future or what tax bracket you're going to be in. And to me, this is so extremely valuable. If we look at the highest tax brackets that have ever been in US history, 94%, if your income was over $200,000, that's a lot. That's a very high tax bracket. Well, it's fair to say maybe not a lot of people were in that tax bracket, but they can change the brackets, they can change the thresholds, and you don't know what your income will be at the end. And because this line is movable, you don't know what your share of that portion of your account balance is going to end up being yours. And that's really valuable. I need to figure out how to unshare. Bear with me. That's really valuable for me to look at and recognize that when you put money into a situation that is deferring tax, you just don't have control over how much you will end up getting of that account balance at the end.
Yeah, and I'd just like to say, reiterate one more time that there are going to be a faction of people that are going to do this, and it's going to be, they're going to be very successful doing it. It's going to be high net worth people that didn't spend to their limits. They actually kept their spending under control. They're going to retire on less money. So, and they're going to have great market timing. So we're not saying it's 100% that you shouldn't do it. Matter of fact, Rachel and I did a podcast on the reasons why you might want to have a little bit of tax deferred money, because of future, to take advantage of the future standard deduction. So you're actually getting the money out tax free. Go back and listen to that episode and you'll see that we're not 100% against this. We're just saying that people have to evaluate this in their financial lives. Okay.
So Bruce, we're going to need to wrap here. We do have another.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing is I think these last two are very easy because we've actually talked about these a lot.
I'm going to say the myth before you say the truth. So the myth is, myth number six is that you should always pay cash. And the reason that we think that is that if we finance, we're going to pay interest. So we think we're going to pay cash to save interest. The real truth is, over to you, Bruce. The truth is?
Yeah. So the real truth is that you pay interest to someone else or you give up interest. So you're always financing things. Mm-hmm. It used to be the last 12 years before this previous year when interest rates were very, very low, that concept was very difficult for people to understand because they're like, well, I'm not earning anything in the bank anyway, or I'm not earning anything on a CD or a money market anyway, so why should I just pay cash? But now when you can get a CD, as Warren talked about, at 5% at your local bank, so people are like, oh, well, I'm going to be giving up 5% if I use this cash. So you finance everything. You're either paying the financing costs or you're giving up the ability to earn money on that. We've talked about this a lot in other podcasts. And the number seven,
there is a concept that came into the business world called economic value added. We have a whole podcast on this as well. When businesses began to recognize that their own capital had a cost, they began making better financial decisions. So you can do that in your own personal life.
Yeah. And finally, your need, this one, I want people to listen to very closely because people misconstrue this all the time. Your need for finance during your lifetime.
Okay, hold on. Are you sharing the myth or the truth, Bruce? Let's make sure we... Okay.
Go ahead.
So the myth is that life insurance is about needs. And people think it's just the amount you need to pay off your house, the amount you need to send your kids to college, the amount you need to whatever. They wrap it all into the financial need that you have. And Bruce, now over to you for the truth.
Yeah, so they said your need for finance during your lifetime exceeds your need for life insurance protection. So that's what Nelson is saying. He says your need for finance, because through his research, one time he did the book, was there was 34.5% of people's income was flowing out towards financing. That is a huge amount. And he said that need is greater than your need for the life insurance protection. Now, he didn't say you didn't need life insurance. He just said that's a greater need. And the reason it's a greater need is because if the 34.5% is flowing out, that could be building up other assets so that you do not need as much life insurance. Now, we don't believe life insurance is a need we think it's a want. You would still want, even if you're covering all that. And he says, if you solve your need for finance through life insurance cash values, you will end up with so much life insurance, you can't get past the underwriters. And so what he's saying is, as you continue to fund the policy through premiums and buying paid up additions, and actually Fritz actually talked about paid up additions in his comments today, you're going to have so much life insurance that you're going to hit your human life value. And that should be the goal of everyone. And the final
sentence, which means as much life insurance as you can get.
Correct. And as the last sentence says, when you hit that, then you will have to insure every person in which you have an insurable interest. And so that's everybody that has insurable interest in your life, family members and business interests. So these are all the points to consider that David Stearns and Nelson actually put in the book, that I think is a really good reference for the and a point of clarity for the rest of the book.
Look, Bruce, we did it. And I think there's so much more that could be said, but I'm not going to promise that we're done with the series on this book, even though we've covered the points to consider, because there are still a few more pages and probably more stuff that we want to say about this book. So please join us next time as we continue unpacking Becoming Your Own Banker. If you have questions, you can directly go ahead and book a call with our advisor team. And what that will do is put you in contact with an advisor who can look at your financial situation and make sure that you're making the best decisions with what you have today, being that outside set of eyes to really look at your situation and help you make decisions, probably outside of what you've been looking at so far, so that you can really have the most today and in the future. So if you have other questions that you'd like us to discuss on the show, we would love to hear those in the comments section. You can also email us at hello@themoneyadvantage.com. Please like and share and subscribe. Send this to a friend that you think that would be helpful for as they're making financial decisions, because it's not just one person. We would like to affect as many as possible who really want to think differently about their thinking and make better financial decisions so that we can all prosper. Thank you so much. We'll be with you next time. And in closing, please remember, success leaves clues. So model the successful few, not the crowd, and build a life and business you love. Discover the secret of how to earn a return on the same money in two places at the same time so that you can strengthen your investment returns. We've created a free guide for you that explains the top three things every investor needs their privatized banking system to do. Go to themoneyadvantage.com/banking, put in your name and primary email address, click the Send My Free Guide button right now, and we'll see you on the inside.